Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Wayne Eddy Affair, to the music of Dwayne Eddy, called Rebel Rouser, my theme song for 50-some years. It was popular in 1958. Oh, my gosh. That's more like 60 years. Well, what do you think? A beautiful morning this morning, plenty of rain. I was watering the flowers yesterday afternoon. And if I would have known it was going to rain like that, and if I would have paid attention to our own weather forecast here on KY, man, I would not have had to water those plants. But it's a relaxing thing to do. Beautiful day yesterday, spring day, not summer yet. I had a gentleman on the air a while back by the name of Glenn Castor, and Glenn is associated with the fire department, and we got chit-chatting about different things, and I invited him to come back and finish our interview because we didn't go all the way through your life. Let's see if I can remember anything, okay? For some reason, I got to believe that you must have been born somewhere in Idaho, maybe Blackfoot.
Blackfoot is where I grew up.
You grew up there?
Yep.
Okay. Now, Blackfoot sounds like an Indian name.
Yeah, there's a reservation right next to this town.
And how big is the town?
Probably 5,000 people when I was there.
Okay, so it was a relatively small town.
Small town, farming community by and large.
Now, what was the reservation like? Did you go there and visit and have students that came to your school and all that?
No, I had friends there. The school district included the reservation, so we all went to school together. And so it was one more place to go.
Yeah, when I first got into broadcasting, I was in Tomah, Wisconsin, which isn't far from the Dells. And I met a guy, and he was a dancer at one of the shows at the Wisconsin Dells for the Native Americans. And they told story by their chanting and dancing. And he just seemed so interesting. And then we got to be pals enough that he invited me over to his place. Now, we were in our early 20s. So you know that we're, going to party. And he took me to where he lived on the reservation, and I was just stunned. I didn't realize the poverty that is exercised on many reservations. We had a good time, I can tell you that.
Good.
He even painted me up and let me wear his headdress, and it was just a good education, you know. But I felt bad for him, a lot of children. Anything experience like that with you?
Well, when I was living in Idaho, that was until I was 13 years old.
Yeah.
So a little different than partying at 20, but
yeah,
the town wasn't a wealthy town at all. So it and the reservation sort of blended into each other. It was potato farming community.
Okay. Well, Idaho.
Yes.
Now, if somebody said, where are you from, Northfield, what they're going to say, St. Olaf College, Carl College, Maltomeal.
Right.
And Sheldahl, the old names.
Mm-hmm.
What would they say about Blackfoot?
Well, at the time I was there, the only big business was the Mental Health Institute, the state mental hospital. I don't think they would say anything. I don't think Blackfoot got noticed.
Okay.
north of Blackfoot in Idaho Falls, there was an Atomic Energy Commission laboratory, and that's where the engines for the Nautilus submarine were built.
Oh, cool.
And we had friends who worked there, and so as a kid, I was able to go up and see what it was like. And then the other side of things was, at that time, there were tests of atomic weapons conducted in Nevada, open-air tests, and the radiation from that would blow over us, depending on how the wind goes.
Really?
So one of the people we knew at who worked at the Atomic Energy Lab, Roy Armstrong, would come down with a Geiger counter. And if it was red high, then I wasn't allowed to play outside for those days.
Did it scare you at all?
Well, I didn't quite understand what it meant.
Yeah.
So it didn't scare me. I think it bothered my parents a lot.
Well, you weren't old enough to have gone through the get-under-the-desk drills, were you?
Oh, yeah.
You were?
Yeah, we had get-under-the-desk drills, and we also had a civil air defense group in town, and one of my father's friends was in that. So I would go out with him, and there was a observation tower north of town where he would watch for planes.
Wow.
And so it was a different atmosphere in which to grow up.
I don't have the music with me, but what year did you graduate from high school?
1965.
Okay.
You know, so this was in the late 1950s.
Yeah. Well, I remember going through little things like that, and the atomic bomb was scary. I mean,
yeah.
It was scary, especially when they showed the mushroom and the houses being mm-hmm. blown apart, you know. Once again, Glenn Castor is my guest here this morning. He's a community-minded individual. We'll talk a little bit more about it. We have already about his involvement with the fire department. But after Blackfoot, Idaho, you moved over to Mount Pleasant in Iowa?
That's right, southeastern Iowa.
And what was in southeastern Iowa that your family moved there?
One more mental hospital, state mental hospital. So my father was a psychologist, and that's where he worked.
Now, Glenn has been a guest of mine before, and we got up to about, well before you were married, and talking about things. So we will do some repetitive things because not everybody listens all the time, and they're hearing you for
yes.
the first time. So if I sound redundant, go along with me, all right?
We can do that.
All right. I appreciate that. Back when your dad in the late 50s, early mm-hmm. 60s was a psychologist, was it as prevalent as it is today in regards to people seeking degrees in that discipline?
I don't think so. It's maybe a more common career now. What's really changed, though, is the by and large, the state mental hospitals don't exist anymore.
And you know, you wonder now when you think about it, particularly here in Rice County, where there were places in Faribault, and I know Cambridge had some. As mm-hmm. a kid taking civil studies in high school in St. Paul, we made a road trip to Cambridge. And we went into the hospital, and it was heartbreaking. It was just unbelievable. I mean, they had big babies, you know, maybe 4 years old in, like, cribs that were to hold them in.
Mm-hmm.
And you saw people with other afflictions and looks and stares and facial, and it was scary. So now they close them, and where do all these people end up?
Well, it seems like you know, the pendulum was on one side where we, in a sense, warehoused people that had problems or that generally we didn't know how to deal with. From that to people are out on their own, and we sort of have a mishmash of programs around to try to deal with this, not very successfully. So now it falls to the criminal justice system, which isn't set up for this at all. So we haven't, as a society, we haven't found our way yet.
And I'm sure that I've seen reports, narratives, documentaries about prisoners that are in by themselves.
Solitary confinement.
Yeah. And these people, and you had, you know, actually footage, video of them in their room doing the craziest things, and they are, it's like they're prisoners, but they're prisoners in their own mind. And the way they deal with these people is hard for society to figure it out after they wiped out all of the institutions. So I don't know if there's ever going to be an answer to that.
Well, I don't know either.
Yeah.
One more problem to deal with.
Yeah. So, and you had a sister, Janet, that's 2 years older?
2 years younger.
2 years younger, and Carolyn, 5 years younger.
That's right.
So you're the big brother. And why did I write down Swarthmore?
Oh, that's where I went to college.
Okay. I thought that was from a movie, Swarthmore, isn't it?
It could have been.
What's that, that real popular English writer that has all these fantasy books, and then they turned into movies, and she went from pauper to multi-billionaire.
J.K. Rowling.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I always thought that maybe that there was a Swarthmore in that movie or something. Anyhow, what high school did you go to?
Mount Pleasant High School.
Mount Pleasant High. How many high schools did they have in that town?
One high school. Mount Pleasant was maybe 8,000 people.
Okay. So did you hang around with other kids whose parents were employed at the mental hospital?
Oh, yeah.
So you had something in common with each other?
Well, it's a small town, so everybody hangs around with everybody.
Okay.
So whether your dad's a psychologist or a farmer really doesn't make too much difference.
And I bet you $5 I asked you this question. Does a parent that is a psychologist have their kids all figured out?
Oh, sure.
I mean, did I ask you that before?
You asked me that before.
And the answer was?
The answer was the same.
Okay. All right. So where is Swarthmore?
Pennsylvania. It's near Philadelphia.
Okay. I'm saying it right, aren't I?
Swarthmore.
Swarth.
Yeah.
Got a TH in there. Swarthmore.
Yeah. So it's a college of about, I think there were about 1,000 students when I went there.
And the reason you chose that all the way from Iowa?
It came to my attention because my mother went there.
Oh, okay. Alumni. Did you get a break on tuition?
No.
No? Okay. Well, how would you compare that? You say 1,000 students. Did it specialize in anything, or is it liberal arts?
No, it's a liberal arts school.
Okay. And so you went away. What was your first year like? Did you live in a dorm?
Oh, yeah. There wasn't really any off-campus housing in the town, so everybody's in a dorm.
Was it connected to any religious organization?
Yeah, it's a Quaker school, sort of in the same sense that St. Olaf is a Lutheran school.
Okay.
So there's plenty of people who are not Quakers who went there. I think when I was there every Thursday morning to school, there's no classes at 10 o'clock, and everybody gathers for an hour to contemplate something about society. And
you were being contemplative.
We were.
Okay. Did they serve donuts and coffee?
No.
Okay. Did your family practice Quakerism? Is that what you would say? Quakerites?
My parents didn't. Other people in our family did. Aunts and uncles. Grandparents.
And, of course, Richard Nixon was a Quaker, wasn't he?
That's nice to associate me with him.
Okay.
Yeah, he was a Quaker. He was a Quaker. Okay. I think he lost the spirit somewhere.
And what did you major in at this four-year college?
Mathematics.
And you tried to figure things out in life? Is that how?
No.
Well, that was supposed to be fun, mathematics.
And
I like mathematics because there's only, I think I mentioned it before, one answer. You can't give an opinion.
Yes, it just turned out to be what I was good at. I tried several things.
Were you really good at arithmetic when you were in grade school?
I was, yeah.
Did you almost enjoy it?
Oh, I did, yeah.
Okay, I liked arithmetic. Then it got to be algebra. And
more pleasure yet.
No. Because you really had to pay attention in class.
That sounds like that must have been a challenge every once in a while.
Oh, it was. And then geometry. And who the heck cares, you know, when you think, well, as you be, I don't use geometry in anything I do, but I see what it means and how it's used, but I couldn't, you know, apply it. And then you get to higher algebra, right? Okay, now are you a student in high school that takes calculus?
No, we didn't have calculus in high school.
Okay, so what was your...
Geometry and trigonometry.
Which one did you enjoy more?
Oh, the geometry by far.
What's the difference between, now trig means three, I think. Trigonometry, would I be right?
Well, it's angles, yeah.
Okay, obtuse, things
yes.
like that. Little things coming back.
That's right, yeah.
So, when you went to Swarthmore, you majored in math, and your purpose at that time as a freshman was, I want to be this in life. And what would that have been originally?
Well, as a freshman, I was clueless as to where I was going, so I went to school and I studied and played tennis. And
that's quite a racket, isn't it?
It is. It is.
Well, if you thought that was funny, it serves you right. But I love saying those things. Am I going out of bounds with the? Oh man, the net results of this whole thing. I don't know. So when did you end up knowing this is where I'm going to go, this is what I want to do, and here's where I'm going to study?
Well, when I was a senior, I was told by my local draft board that I'm going to be drafted. So I graduated in 1969.
Yeah.
So they told me months ahead of time, here's what's going to happen. So I didn't really worry about where I was going with mathematics.
Okay, and because you were the only son, had no bearing on your draft availability.
No.
And because you didn't have a family yourself, that made you even more eligible. And then now you have a college degree, and if you're going to get drafted, it's going to be in the Army. So did you decide to join, or did you get drafted?
No, I got drafted. What had happened was previously there had been deferments for graduate school, and those went away in, I think, 1968. So I got drafted and did my 2 years.
Okay, now, when you did your 2 years in 1969, we're talking Vietnam, and with a college degree, after basic training, were you dubbed a second lieutenant?
No. No, I was dubbed an artilleryman, and at that point I volunteered for officer's training, and went through that and got to the end of that. And there were lots of college students in the that officer training class, and we all had the same thought, which was, this is 6 months that we're not in Vietnam. So at the end of that, we all did the same thing, which was we resigned from officer training school and went back to being enlisted people.
And the benefit was?
Six months here and not there.
Okay. Did you ultimately end up there?
For a short time, yes.
Okay. Now, artillery and math background, it seems to me that's a pretty good marriage.
It is. It is. And I think that's why the Army did it. But who knows? I mean, from what I saw, the Army is a somewhat irrational place.
Okay, you're not the only one that says that. Glenn Castor is my guest here this morning on KYMN Radio. He is retired, lives in Bridgewater Township, and is a township supervisor.
That's right.
Okay. And some of the things that you and I are talking about right now are new to many listeners. So once again, I hail you for appreciating my being redundant. So now you're an artillery guy. You know, you got to figure out all the angles so that you use the right shell and the right caliber, whatever the terminology is, so you can drop this bomb or bullet or rocket or whatever they shoot out of there in a place that could be defined as maybe as big as this room or as small as this room, or
well, you hope you're that close.
Okay, so did you actually use your skills in
yes.
Vietnam?
Yes.
Okay, so you were behind the lines.
Right.
How does that work?
Well, this was an artillery base, so we're the guns are there for, you know, everything is set, and there's a what's called a fire control center, which is where a forward observer who's typically out with the infantry or he's in a small plane calls in to say, put shells here. You know, and so the fire control center figures out where here is with respect to the guns and gives the instructions.
And does topography have a lot to do with it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Because you have to go over bunkers or hills or mountains?
You're typically shooting 10 to 15 miles away from where the guns are located.
Wow.
So it's not only the topography, but it's the weather. Shells are going high in the air. So what's the wind like, 2,000 feet up and so forth?
So that'd be like dropping a bomb in downtown Faribault or even further.
Yeah.
That is amazing, isn't it?
It is. Parts of it aren't very nice to think about.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, I had friends who were in the infantry, and that they don't like to talk about it, and I understand that. But were you the guy that would put the thing in the thing and then plug your ears?
No.
The old World War II?
No, there were other people doing that.
Okay. Were you, like, in an office? And you didn't have computers back then, of course.
Well, that's why I was there. We had the first computer that was used for fire control.
Okay.
Before that, you had a set of books that gave you various things, and you looked it up, and you had a special kind of slide rule that was used, and so forth, to calculate all this. And you need to do it really rapidly and not make mistakes.
What about how big was the computer? I mean, weren't they almost room size? Or?
No, this had been built especially for artillery use, and it was about the size of an electric piano.
Okay.
It was on a stand like an electric piano.
Okay.
And so forth.
Would you be outside or would you be inside?
You're in a tent.
You're in a tent. Yeah. Okay. So how long do you have to serve over there?
I was there for only 6 weeks.
6 weeks, son. Yep. That was long enough. And then you came home and...
I spent the last few months in lovely Fort Carson, Colorado, Colorado Springs.
Okay.
At the foot of Pikes Peak.
Oh, yeah. It's beautiful in that area. Did you enjoy that?
No.
Okay, well...
I mean, the area was nice. There's better ways to be there than being in an Army base.
What did you do after those 6 weeks on the Army base?
At that point, Fort Carson was sort of a holding tank for people getting out of the Army. So everybody is a short timer.
Well, what did they do to keep you busy?
We swept the motor pool. We polished vehicles. We would go out and just shoot guns.
On the range,
yeah. Anything to keep us busy.
Okay. Now, did you have the highest ranking outside of being an officer?
No, I was a sergeant.
A sergeant.
The lowest grade sergeant.
Like an E4, E5?
E5.
Okay. Yeah. So you're just waiting to get out of there. So how long were you there?
Probably 4 months.
Okay. And so now you get your discharge papers.
Yeah, September 16th.
You don't remember?
1971. Yeah. I got them at 4 o'clock and I was gone.
Wow. And where'd you go?
Oh, I drove back to see my parents. And
in
Iowa.
Mount Pleasant?
Yeah, and then okay. I went on a tour to see old girlfriends. And
is that a plural?
That was a plural. There was more than one. And then on that tour...
Were you wearing your uniform?
Oh, no.
Like
no.
You just got on. Of course, did you have any of that... you know how back then when people would come back from Vietnam, they would be harassed and spit on and all that, and so some guys would, you know, get their uniform.
No, I didn't experience
you didn't,
any of that.
Okay, I'm glad to hear that. Yeah. So the first girlfriend said, "Oh, I'm glad to see you're back."
That's right. So I went sort of across the country and then met the woman I knew in college, and we meshed.
Meshed. That's good, isn't it?
That's good.
Okay.
That was good. She was in Boston in graduate school, and so we ended up getting married in 1972.
Oh, that was quick.
It was quick.
Out in 71 and got married in 72?
Yeah.
Did she, what degree did she get doing her graduate work?
Well, she eventually got a PhD in anthropology.
Well, that's important. Anthropology. Yeah. Is that the study of mankind?
The study of mankind, and she eventually turned into a potter.
Mr. Potter, no. And I didn't write her name down here.
It's Barbara Zavaruja.
Ba, ba, ba. Is that your theme
that
song?
One.
Barbara.
Yes.
And Sutha?
Zavaruja.
Zavaruja. What is Zavaruja?
It's a Ukrainian
okay.
name.
Barbara. Okay, let's see if I get that. All right, got it. Now I'm going to take a break, all right?
Fine.
You know who I'm going to talk about first?
I'll learn and listen.
All right, I am going to talk about a place called the Quarterback Club, located right here in Northfield, Minnesota, and they have some wonderful, wonderful things for dinner. Now, today, if you want to go in, they have specials every day, and on Wednesday, they have shrimp basket and a shrimp dinner and a turkey dinner with mashed potatoes and gravy and a vegetable. That's their special today. But, of course, don't forget they're open for breakfast from 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. They serve breakfast Monday through Friday, 7 a.m. to 10 a.m. on Saturday, none on Sunday. And they have all kinds of wonderful foods, from soups to baby back barbecued pork ribs. I'll tell you, locally owned, locally managed, 50 years in business right here in Northfield, Minnesota. I don't think any restaurant in town can claim that long. Although the Oli Cafe, I think QB would be the oldest one. We're going to continue our conversation on KYMN Radio with Glenn Castor, and we are going to find out about Barbara and anthropology. We'll be right back.
Affordable living could be yours at Northfield Manor. Located on the campus of the Northfield Retirement Community, the Manor offers HUD-supported one-bedroom apartments for seniors age 62 and older, or for persons with a disability. If your annual income is less than $43,750 per year, you could qualify. Northfield Manor tenants enjoy all the amenities that the Northfield Retirement Community campus has to offer. For more information, call 507-650-7332 today. Northfield Retirement Community. Innovation. Choice. Tradition.
Do you have an old junker car in the garage or on the farm? Call Huber's Auto Parts in Faribault, 507-332-2300. Get the most cash for your old junker vehicle and have it taken away for free. Huber's Auto Parts in Faribault, 507-332-2300.
Get out of my room.
It's my room, too.
Why are you always in my business?
Why are you always a dummy head?
Good one.
Mom, Laura sarcastically complimented me.
Mom, Emily's on my side of the room.
Mom, we can't share a room any longer.
Stop complaining. I have to share a room with your baby brother and your father. Is your family in need of more space? Let Professional Pride Realty in Northfield help guide you through the process of selling your current house and finding the home that is right for your growing family. Professional Pride Realty, providing good information so you can make good decisions.
We're back on KYMN Radio, a friend you can count on. My guest this morning is a gentleman by the name of Glenn Caster, and his last name is spelt with an E on the end, so I want to say Castore. And he is now in 1972 out of getting the out of the Army in 1971. He went cross-country to Boston, found Barbara, an old college friend, and she finished off her degree in anthropology. And now you are a Vietnam veteran. You served our country. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Today, by the way, is D-Day. This is when they stormed the beaches in Normandy. Mm-hmm. So now what do you do? You've got a degree in what? What did you end up getting?
Well, I had a degree in mathematics.
Okay.
Barbara, at this point when we were married, she was looking at finishing her anthropology degree. She didn't have it yet.
Okay.
So we moved to Chicago, where her professor was moving from Boston to Northwestern University. So at the beginning, we looked at getting some jobs and working. And so that's what we did for a couple years.
In Chicago?
In Chicago.
Did you live in Chicago?
We lived right immediately north in Evanston.
Evanston, Illinois. Okay.
Right.
I think there's an Evanston, Indiana, too, if I remember correctly.
Yes.
So what job did you get, and what did she get?
Well, there was a recession at the time, so jobs were scarce.
72.
This was 72, 73.
Okay.
Jobs were scarce, so you'd go out and interview, and the answer is no, and you'd look in the paper and try to find some more. But eventually I ended up with a company called Marimont. They liked people with mathematics backgrounds, and what I did was proofread auto parts catalogs.
Wow. Did you learn about cars more than you ever?
Oh, I learned, you know, the 1963 Chevy could use this tailpipe or that tailpipe. And
do you still have connections?
No, I don't know if Marimont even exists anymore.
No, the reason I asked that is...
you need some parts.
The right taillight of my 75 Oldsmobile got busted, and a body man I know looked it up, and they found one. Guess how much they wanted for it? Just the not the whole assembly, just the glass and all that. Of course, now they want... They want you to take the whole assembly.
Sure.
What do you think that cost today?
Oh, just today for just the glass, I don't know, $57.
Well, the taillight replacement, they want $650.
So are you going to pay?
Well, I think he found it on, like, Craigslist or one of those things, or what's those other...
Oh, yeah.
Anyhow, we both laughed. You know, I don't need it that bad. So anyhow, that had to be tedious. It seems to me.
Oh, it was awfully tedious.
And did you have to then correct things that were wrong?
Oh yeah.
Well, yeah. Anything could be wrong. You could have a number wrong.
No, generally two people work together, and one person would read the copy that what was to be printed, and the other person would read the original. It would check with parts books and see if it was all right. It was a really boring job.
Oh my gosh, it had to be. Did you have a partner that was at least easy to get along with?
Oh yeah.
Okay. Man, I can't imagine going there at 8 in the morning and start reading numbers and descriptions and comparing.
You're really ready to go home at the end of the day.
Was it a good paying job for a young man?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. In that sense, it was pretty good.
How long were you there?
I think I worked there 2 years.
Okay.
And then decided to go back to graduate school on the GI Bill.
Yeah, take advantage of that.
Yes.
What did you go back to school for?
Mathematics again.
To get a...
Well, I got eventually a PhD at Syracuse University. So in Chicago, I went to University of Illinois at Chicago.
A PhD. You are a doctor.
I am.
Wow. Do you use that in your letterhead?
I don't. But when we first moved to Northfield, I was able to teach a couple classes at St. Olaf, something I'd always been curious about, how would I do as a teacher.
Well, what job did Barbara get?
She went back to Northwestern to finish her PhD.
Yeah.
And then in 1978 and 79, she was in West Africa doing field work.
For
her PhD, for a thesis.
And to write about how the aid is necessary or how the society is? Or?
She was looking at what happens when people from different tribes marry. So she was in Ghana in West Africa. There's, I think, something like 15 or 18 different tribal groups. So they all have different rules as to how everything from how you raise your kids to who inherits what to what role does your mother-in-law have in your life.
Yeah. So, did that cause consternation? And, you know, you hear about horrible tribal fights in that part of the world.
Oh, well, in these, some people figured out how to make these marriages work and some didn't.
Okay. You know, who's worth 12 ox or who's worth three lambs or whatever. All right, but now so you're bachelor was she?
I was at Syracuse University when she was over there, so
okay.
That was poor judgment on my part. I just should have gone with her.
Yeah. But you did get your degree, your doctorate degree. Kids, do you have kids?
We did. We didn't at that time. Just as I finished, we had a daughter, Allison.
Allison, okay. What? When was Allison born?
Oh, that's a good question. Let's see. That's probably, I think, 1980, 1981.
Okay, so that makes her how old?
So she's 38.
Okay.
And she just had a baby herself.
Oh, so your grandpa.
That's right.
Okay, what's your grandson, granddaughter?
Grandson, Larkin.
Larkin. Yeah. Oh, that's a nice name, Larkin. That name sounds familiar, Larkin something, some business name, Larkin, yeah. Movers or something. It is 17 minutes before 10 o'clock on the Wayne Eddy Affair. My guest this morning is Glenn Castor. Glenn is a supervisor in Bridgewater Township and has a doctorate degree in mathematics, and his wife has a doctorate degree in
anthropology.
And that was that hard for you to have your wife, the love of your life, in Africa for almost 2 years?
Yeah, it was difficult, and not, as it turns out, not many marriages survive field work. Amongst our friends who were anthropologists at the time, I would say maybe 1 out of 10 marriages made it.
Wow. You're that one.
And I was over there. I was able to go over one summer for 3 months.
How did you like that?
Oh, I loved it.
Well, tell me a little bit about that. People are interested in things like that. Were there cars?
Oh, at this time in Ghana had been a British colony.
Okay.
And became independent in the early 60s, one of the first to become independent. It was a very extremely comfortable place to be, just in terms of dealing with people and feeling safe, being able to get around.
Where did you live?
She was in a farming community of about 40,000 people. It was a market town.
And all Guyanians?
Yeah, I think in the town at the time I visited her there were probably 10 or 12 Caucasians.
Was there any prejudice?
No, not really. It's a different type of world in many, many ways.
Okay. Is that the place where Jones and...
No.
Where am I thinking?
I think that was Ivory Coast, which is the next country over.
Okay. Well, it's close.
Yeah. Yes.
So when you went over there, how long did you stay?
3 months.
And in those 3 months, were you able to accumulate great wealth?
I didn't accumulate great wealth. I learned a little bit of the language.
Yeah.
And got around to see things.
What do you
so forth.
What do you remember in Guyanian?
Oh, virtually nothing.
not hello or goodbye or?
No.
Do you speak English or anything?
I speak English, that's it.
No. So there wasn't a lot of intercourse, conversation with the Guyanians.
Oh no, there was. I mean, we lived in a little community. So our next door neighbors, who were literally right next to us, they're Guyanians. All the people around us are Guyanians. There were some doctors from India that we knew. But it was a Guyanian community, and so Barbara got to be where she could go to the market and get what she wanted and mm-hmm. conduct a simple conversation. And
did you see any of the tribes have rivalry or animosity?
Not really too much. When Ghana was formed, the first president was Kwame Nkrumah, and he decreed that we will not pay attention to tribal differences in politics or in other parts of our how we deal with each other, and that was enforced pretty strictly. So when Barbara first went over, her first what she had intended to do was talk to people of different tribes about how they approached politics, and people just absolutely would not talk about it. So she switched and, okay, let's talk about marriage and how different tribes approach marriage, and that was, everybody was willing to talk at that point.
Now, did you attend any weddings?
We several weddings.
Was there a great deal of?
Oh, they're good parties.
Celebration and wedding gowns or men, you know, colorful. What?
They were just good parties like our weddings. I mean, colorful. I would say, in generally, people dress more colorfully than they do here.
Yeah. Now, did they have a television station?
There might have. Well, I know there was a radio station. One of the weddings we went to, we went into the capital city, Accra, and it was during an attempted coup. So there were soldiers there. They were getting a hold of the radio station. The wedding went ahead. The coup did not.
Gosh. Was it scary?
Well, certain things about it are different. You know, when I first got there and I'm in the airport, there's soldiers around with guns and mostly looking for people who were trading on the black market.
What were they trading?
Dollars.
Okay. What it was, you know, in the towns that you lived in, both in Iowa and in Idaho, they had mental institutions, mm-hmm. which were employed a lot of people, and therefore the commerce was good, I assume. So what was it in the town that you lived in Ghana? What was their main staple of employment?
Kofor Ijua was the name of the town. And it was surrounded by lots of farms, smaller farms than we have here typically, but 80 acres would be a good-sized operation. But that was it. It was agriculture.
Okay.
So it was both. That was the trading in the town, and then goods would be shipped from Kofarijwa to other parts of the country.
Now, how far would that have been from a large body of water?
It was from a large body of water. The ocean is probably the closest thing.
Okay. How far would that have been?
Probably 80 to 100 miles.
Okay. Did you go to the beach there?
No.
Okay. Were there any tourist attractions in that little town?
Not in Kofarijwa.
Okay.
No. The other town that she was in, which I didn't go to, Obuasi, was a gold mining town. And some people would come to see the gold mines.
What was the transportation system like?
rough and ready. So roads were marginal. You would have, if you wanted to go from Kofarijwa to Accra or to some other city, generally you got on a bus or what was called a trotro, which would be a jazzed up pickup truck or something with 10 people
hanging all over it,
and you're one of the 10, and you hope the driver's paying attention.
Yeah. Okay. What would be the main agricultural thing? Did they export? Did they go to local markets? The 80-acre big farm there. What did they produce?
Well, I think it was for them, for this particular area, it was mostly local markets in Ghana. And all sorts of things were produced, from palm wine to types of eggplants and meat, slaughtering probably sheep, some cattle.
Were under refrigeration or hanging from the ceiling?
No, hanging from the ceiling.
Okay. Flies?
Slaughter it and sell it.
Flies?
Oh, yeah. Flies and ants.
Oh, what kind of ants? Not fire ants.
No.
Okay. That would have been something else. So what about the nightlife in a town like that?
No, there wasn't any.
Okay. So what did you and Barbara do to entertain yourself when she wasn't at work on her thesis?
Visit people. We would travel around a little bit. She had friends in other parts of the country. So along the Volta River, there was a little village we went to several times.
Now, did you have a car?
No, she had a motorcycle.
Barbara did?
Yes.
And so you sat on the back, or did
I
you?
Sat on the back.
You know how many cc's it was?
No, it was a little Yamaha 250, I think.
Okay. That's a nice little get-around.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're going to take a final break this hour on the Wayne Eddy Affair. My guest this morning is Glenn Castor. He is a Bridgewater Township supervisor. He's also on some sort of fire commission, fire department deal. And in addition to that, I don't know what he did before he started doing volunteer work, high-paying job as a supervisor in Bridgewater Township. It is 6 before 10.
The Connects Nurseries Garden Center on Highway 19 West in Northfield carries a huge inventory of perennials, shrubs, and trees for every landscaping need, including proven winners, color choice, flowering shrubs. Connects Nurseries in Northfield is open 7 days a week from April to November and features proven winners, color choice shrubs, so you can choose from the newest and best flowering shrub varieties. Shop Connects Nurseries in Northfield for the best selection, quality, and value, including proven winners shrubs.
Residential or commercial, Cannon Valley Water in Dundas is the place to call for water. Whether it's a complete water conditioning system or just salt delivery and filters, Cannon Valley Water can take care of it. And Cannon Valley Water can also deliver Candy Yohai premium water right to your house or business at great rates, too. Chippewa Springs is as pure today as it was when we first tested it over a century ago, and is proudly distributed by Cannon Valley Water. Pickups are now located at 609 Stafford Lane in Dundas, just behind Aldi. Call Cannon Valley for your water today.
Hi, I'm April Kopak, manager at Three Links Apartments in Northfield. We are an active, independent community of older adults and disabled individuals. Our spacious one-bedroom apartments feature controlled key access, off-street parking, and are handicap accessible. This is a place to call home, make new friends, and participate in many activities and exercises. Tours are welcome. Please call Three Links Apartments at 664-8850 or find out more at threelinks.org.
Welcome back to the Wayne Eddy Affair on your radio station, KYMN. And now 95.1, the 1 FM. And if you woke up to rain today, well, it's starting to clear up. The sunshine is coming out, and the plants are just bursting out of the ground, and leaves are covered. I just love this time of the year. My guest this morning, Glenn Castor. What was the weather like in Ghana, in speaking about weather?
Well, when I
might as well turn your mic on. What the heck? There you go.
When I was there, it was three months, June, July, August. Pleasant weather, once in a while rain.
Okay, and no maybe, monsoon or anything like that?
No monsoon. Probably 70 to 80 degrees every day.
Oh, that's perfect.
Very nice.
Yeah. That's perfect. Comfortable. So did American have a big influence on the Ghanaians, or were they more England, British type?
No, it was Americans didn't have much influence there. It was, but you could easily see the remainder of the British colonial system.
Did they have, you know, sometimes people are surprised they go to a foreign country and they're not liked, that the people don't like America, USA.
At least at this time, that wasn't true at all there. It was a very, very comfortable place to be.
And you're glad you did it.
Very much so.
And you made a lot of money.
Not there.
Did you help Barbara with her thesis?
Not really, no.
Oh, you didn't type for her?
I didn't type for her. I stayed out of the way.
Okay, so now it's 1973.
Well, it's actually about 1979.
79. Ooh. And when did you come back? When did you and Barbara get together stateside permanently?
I think that was either the spring of 1979 she came back.
And where were you living, in Chicago?
In Syracuse.
In Syracuse.
Syracuse, New York.
Yeah, that's where you were getting your doctorate. Okay. Yeah. And so were you a part-time employee to, you know, be able to eat? The GI Bill helped you, but you had to rent an apartment, I assume, and you had to eat, and you had to get from here to there?
I was a teaching assistant, so there's no – so the GI Bill didn't go to the school. It just went to our living expenses.
Oh, okay.
And we had made some money working before we went back to school.
And smart enough to save it.
And we saved it, yeah.
Okay. So did you live in a one-room apartment or two-bedroom apartment?
We had a two-bedroom apartment within walking distance of
the
school.
Who got the one that you turned into an office?
I forget what we did with the second.
Okay.
Second bedroom.
So how long did you stay at Syracuse in that community? What community?
Syracuse, New York. Okay. And Syracuse University. Yeah. Mostly known for basketball rather than mathematics.
Yes.
We left there in 1981.
All right. Now, 1980 was a horrendous year. I was using... yesterday I played music, the top 10 tunes from 1980, and the interest rate,
oh yes,
21.5%, and I got stuck with a loan that the bank switched from a personal loan to a business loan. The usury law was 8% at the time, They called the note, and I'm going, well, what did I do wrong? I've been making my payments. Well, we're going to switch it from personal to a business loan. 20%.
Yep.
Oh, I couldn't.
No, that was a dismal time for the economy.
Was that Carter? Jimmy Carter, I think, was in office at that time. Well, we'll find out what happened after Syracuse and how the heck you ended up in Bridgewater Township right after the news coming up next on the Wayne Eddy Affair. All right, sir?
That's fine.
All right. My guest is Glenn Kester. This is the 95.1 FM, 1080 on your AM dial for nearly 50 years. From Northfield, Minnesota.
Decisive elections, death toll climbs in Guatemala. I'm John Trout. Voters outlined the November ballot in 8 state primary races yesterday. In the California governor's race, Republican business executive John Cox will square off with a top-ranking state Democrat.
Cox makes it through. The president tweeted his support, urging Republicans to go out there and vote. He makes it through. Gavin Newsom, the lieutenant governor, the Democrat, also the decisive victor.
There's Kuhn Law in Newport Beach, California. In Hawaii, Kilauea is changing neighborhoods forever.
The power of Madam Pele, as they call her, Hawaii's fire goddess, to reclaim her land, as they say, completely covering once scenic Kapoho Bay with lava that stretches 3/4 of a mile now out into the sea, is unbelievable.
There's no more swimming, no more bike rides, no more walking the dogs around the neighborhood. It's gone forever.
Angela Robertson says all they have now are pictures and memories.
The story even more grim in Guatemala, where the Fuego volcano has claimed at least 75 lives. Patrick Oppmann is there.
Guatemala is observing 3 days of mourning as funerals begin for the few victims that have been identified. White paper signs taped to their coffins list the names of parents, friends, and children.
The nation's international trade deficit is lower. The Commerce Department shows April figures were $1 billion less than the March deficit. Now, Mexico is slapping tariffs on $3 billion worth of American goods. Like what?
Pork, apples, potatoes, cheese, and bourbon. It's a reaction to President Trump's hefty tariffs on steel and aluminum against Canada and Mexico in an effort to pressure them to reach a new NAFTA agreement. Meantime, the European Union says in July it will start imposing duties on a list of U.S. products in response to President Trump's tariffs on steel and aluminum from Europe. Scott Carr, Washington.
The late Kate Spade's sister said the designer was fixated on the suicide of comedian Robin Williams, who also took his own life by hanging. Spade was found dead yesterday. She was 55. I'm John Trout.
When I get older, losing my head, many years from now, will you still be sending me a Valentine? Birthday greetings, bottle of wine. If I'd been out till 2:45, would you lock the door? Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
Boom, boom. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to your radio station. This is the 95.1 FM. I'm watching a lady parking across the street, and it's pretty interesting to watch people park. I'm a bad parker myself, so I should not laugh. But anyhow, we're from Northfield, Minnesota. My guest this morning from Bridgewater Township is Glenn Kester. And last we left off, last hour, was in Syracuse, New York, Syracuse University. And Glenn got his doctorate degree in mathematics, and his wife, Barbara, got her doctor's degree in anthropology. And now you got these two sheepskins. Remember that expression?
I remember, yes.
Okay. And, I mean, your doctor's okay. You're ready to go. And so she has her career, and you have your career goals. So what do you do?
Well, we had a daughter.
All right.
So
that would be Allison.
Allison was born while we were in Syracuse. And so that took care of Barbara's career. She was a stay-at-home mother, which she wanted to do very much. And then I worked for the National Institute of Standards and Technology in Washington. We had moved to Maryland.
So that's a federal position?
Yeah.
Okay, so you're a government employee.
Government employee.
And do they rate with a G rather than an E, right? You were an E5, and then now you're a G.
I was a G.
And
12 or 13 or 14, something like that.
Well, that's pretty high.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good paying job. So what did you do?
Well, the National Institute of Standards and Technology is an unusual place. It is essentially a scientific laboratory across lots of disciplines with superb people. Two of the people that were there when I was there, I didn't work with them, but won Nobel Prizes. I mean, it's that caliber of people you're working with. And it's a lovely setting. It's a huge campus, park, deer running around, and so forth. And what I did was work in a group called Dimensional Metrology. So we did two things. I mean, one thing is, you know, how make sure that when everybody measures an inch on a ruler, it's the same every time you do it. There's a whole procedure for that. The more interesting part of the work was to make sure that machines, mostly machine tools and measuring machines, were accurate down to millionths of an inch. So that was really a fascinating work.
Well, would you, I like to keep things simple, if I may. So let's say that you're working for the USDA, and you stamp prime or you stamp good or whatever, and they inspect, and it's a private company, but they have a federal employee in there taking mm-hmm. care of it. Now, did people have to go through you, or would that your the dimensional, whatever it is, did they have to get your approval to make a ruler or protractor or a bit or?
No, they didn't have to get our approval. But what they did was there's special little metal blocks called gauge blocks that are used in companies as your ultimate standard. So if you're making something like a twist drill and it's going to be a quarter inch in diameter, this is ultimately how you determine what a quarter inch means. So they would send the gauge blocks into us. We would check them and send them back with a certificate. The more interesting work, the reason dimensional metrology became really important was weapons manufacturing. So in all of the labs that manufactured atomic weapons had extremely high precision machines.
How about rifles? Well, you know that at the latter part of Vietnam, the M16 didn't work very well.
Yeah, it was not really a reliable.
Yeah, and which put everybody, you know, at danger, couldn't protect themselves. Now, would that company have had gone through your program to make sure everything was going to work properly?
No, we don't make sure things work properly. We just make sure that if you say something is an inch long, it's actually an inch long.
Okay.
So in terms of setting up a factory, it's important.
So who comes to you? I mean, who are your clients, or who are you overlooking? I mean,
well, all of the military came to us.
Okay.
So so when the military sets up a contract with somebody to make something, whether it's a ship or a rifle, you know, the company starts with us to make sure that things are being measured properly.
And evidently, for a person like me, I think of an inch and a foot and a yard and a rod or whatever. But you said millionth of an inch.
Well, we were typically checking, like if you have a block an inch long,
mm-hmm.
You don't want it. It shouldn't vary more than maybe five millionths of an inch over okay. an inch.
So what is a what does a block look like? How
it's just a little piece of metal.
Yeah.
That's maybe an inch long, hopefully, and a quarter of an inch high, and maybe 3/4 of an inch wide.
Okay.
A special material.
Okay.
And special manufacturing process.
Are there any bigger than that?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They come in all sizes. And fascinating
so,
work.
Well, is what was the challenge?
Well, the challenge really was in the machines. So if you think about making, take something like a fender on a car. So here's a drawing that has dimensions for the fender and curves and so forth. How do you check that that's correct? Well, the way it's checked is it's put on a machine called a measuring machine that moves around and touches different points of it and says yes or no, this fits the drawing. So checking that machine is operating the way it's advertised is a real challenge. And that was most of our work.
Now, does it also pick up on the gauge of a piece of equipment?
Yes.
So this machine that's measuring, is it robotic?
Yes.
Back in the 80s?
Yep.
Okay. And that would take the whatever it is and move it all around and get the upper view, bottom view, da 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 da.
Yes.
All of those things.
All of those things.
And then you stood there and watched it.
We stood there and watched it, and then we figured out ways in which to check that it was actually correct.
How it's very complex, obviously. I mean, you're a doctorate of mathematics, but no, I am not. So how important is that job?
Well, when you're doing it, it's very important. It's your paycheck. but, like, think about parts going into an aircraft engine.
Okay.
So here is a large nut that's say 8 inches in diameter, and it's going to screw on to a shaft and hold part of a turbine together. The tolerances on the part are probably on the order of 1/1 of an inch to 0.5. So the measuring machine should be measuring those to 0.1 of an inch to 0.05 of an inch. Ideally.
Wow.
That's how precise the measuring machine should be. Now, if you want to check the measuring machine itself, ideally you're down around 0.1 of an inch to 0.04 of an inch checking its motions.
What type of microscope would you need to be able to measure 0.04 of an inch?
Most of it is lasers.
Oh, okay.
You use lasers as okay. Is the measuring device, and you're measuring at that point lots of things about the machine, because a machine that's built of steel, for example, steel expands at about 0.07 of an inch per inch per degree. So if the temperature in the room changes, the size of your machine changes. So its measurements change.
Amazing.
It was exotic.
Yeah.
And there are places in the country. Oak Ridge, for example, was one.
In Tennessee?
In Tennessee.
Okay.
There's a national lab there.
Yeah.
But the machines are designed to run in rooms where there are the people can't be in the rooms when the machines are measuring.
Why?
Because people generate heat.
Oh.
And you're standing next to the machine, so part of the machine is expanding faster than other parts. And it's actually measurable. You can see it.
Okay, so for a layman like myself, they're going to build a nuclear submarine, okay? Do all once you have, and I don't know the terminology, mm-hmm. but when I took a little electronics course, they called them schematics.
Yes.
So I don't know what you call it, but once you have the blueprint or mm-hmm. whatever it's called.
A blueprint.
Of the entire submarine, every part and little part on there, and it all has to be, what, watertight. So very precise. Would then the private corporation that's going to build a submarine have to go through your particular surveillance to make sure that all of the parts are the screws, the bolts, the whatever are all going to pass mustard and be able to hold that submarine together?
Yeah, it was pretty common for us to work with the private corporations that made the parts. And what we are checking are the gauges that they use,
okay.
not the parts themselves. They check the parts. We check that the gauges are accurate.
Okay, I get it now.
Yeah.
It's coming on, a little light over here. So how long did you do that job?
So I was there for 4 years, 1985. We moved to Minneapolis, and I worked for Control Data.
All right, and how did that happen?
Well, Maryland was getting, the area where we lived was very crowded. And
were you like the second outer belt?
Yeah, we lived up to, near the Potomac River, okay. out in a little town in Maryland.
All right.
So there were several things about the communities there that were just getting to be uncomfortable. So we decided to move from the area and looked at a number of jobs. And we, Minneapolis, when we came here, we just instantly liked it.
Are people in your profession, or the profession you were at there, are in demand, few and far between? I mean, could you just like pretty much get a job wherever you wanted?
No, there aren't. There isn't a heavy demand for people in metrology.
Okay. Yeah. So how did you learn about a job at, did you say Control Data?
Control Data.
Yeah.
They were advertising for people. They were building computer systems to design parts for cars and airplanes and so forth. That's the group that I worked with.
So you learn about that in a trade magazine or through word of mouth?
No, I think I don't even recall how I learned.
Okay. Well, having lived in Iowa and Idaho, I mean, you knew what St. Paul and Minneapolis were like in regards to temperature.
They were very easy to get around. I mean, they're sizable cities, and that there's plenty to do. And it's compared to Washington D.C. or New York City.
I chuckle because the traffic on 35W and 394.
It's dismal right now, isn't it?
Oh, it's going to be like that for months.
Yeah, months, maybe years.
Who does the guy interview with when you call them and say, hey, listen, I'd like to come in for, you know, nowadays everything's online. So how does a guy in your position with a doctorate degree going to a large, successful corporation connect?
Well, that was one of the things I learned. This wasn't a large, successful corporation. This was a corporation on the way to bankruptcy. But at any rate, you know, they gave a contact, and I called up, and they said, come on out, bring your wife. You know, we'll pay for 3 days to interview, and you can look around for a house and so forth. So,
wow, that's a pretty nice offer.
That's what we did.
Okay.
We found a place to live and eventually moved.
In where did you move to? In
Roseville.
Roseville,
yeah.
Okay.
Just the first suburb north of St. Paul.
And I know where that is. I sold shoes in Roseville at the Tom McCann shoe store, which isn't there anymore. It's an appliance store.
Yes, and but we lived very close to there.
And Lexington and Larpenter. And I was a manager of a Henry's Drive-In, which was identical to McDonald's, but it's called Henry's. Uh-huh. And they went out of business like Control Data. Mm-hmm. So where was your plant or office?
In Arden Hills. So that's a farther north suburb. Yeah.
Up by the old artillery...
ammunition plant.
Ammunition
plant.
Yeah,
Honeywell's ammunition plant.
Yeah. Yeah. So now, control data. When I was a kid, 21, 20 years old, and I was dating this young lady, and her mother was dating a guy. And when the guy picked up her mom, he had on a suit and tie and a trench coat, and he probably was 30, or no, maybe older. But anyhow, I'm outside, and he's waiting for her to come out, and they're going to go out. And he said, "Hey, kid, if you ever want to get involved in the stock market, let me tell you now, control data. That's the way to go, control data." And I'm going, "What is the stock market?" Yeah, I know that in South St. Paul, yeah, they have the all these pigs and stuff. But anyhow, Control Data was a very successful company.
Oh, it was.
And when you joined them, where were they?
In the mid-'80s, they were on their way down.
And why would have that been?
Because they didn't believe in the personal computer. That was probably the biggest thing. And the second biggest thing was they really didn't believe in something called a virtual operating system, which every computer has now.
What is a virtual operating system?
It's a simpler way to manage the memory in a computer.
Okay.
But so they still had the fastest machines in terms of how fast you could add two numbers or do a complicated equation, but the machines were getting more difficult to use. More companies were looking at PCs, and Control Data wasn't. So it just didn't change fast enough.
So Control Data's success was in the corporate computer.
That's right.
Which were as big as this room at that time, or when they first were being developed. And they just didn't stay up with the times and didn't anticipate, would you call this a personal computer?
Yeah.
And so it's amazing that...
So it sort of broke apart. The company sort of disintegrated.
I mean, and we had IBM. And Control Data also served the military, didn't they?
Oh yeah,
in rockets and things like that.
Well, they had some electronics products that went into control systems, and they spun off Cray Research, which Seymour Cray started his career with Control Data, and. Cray computers for a while were the be-all and end-all of fast computing. So that was the world that Control Data lived in. And it just
What effect did IBM have on them?
Well, a strong effect. IBM was their main competitor for a lot of contracts, a lot of businesses. And IBM did pay attention to the personal computer, and Control Data didn't. That was.
So how long were you at Control Data?
I was there 2 years and then moved to Honeywell.
2 years?
Yeah.
Okay, and you saw the light?
Oh, yeah, yeah, the light.
When did you see the light?
The light was pretty easy to see. It was very bright.
Well, you didn't see it before you went there?
No, I didn't. I had an uncle who worked for Control Data, and... anyway, no, I didn't see the light. But once I was there, it was evident that this not everything was clicking on all cylinders here.
Was part of your compensation stock options?
No. The only part that mattered was they paid for my move from Maryland to here, and I had to stay with the company for a year, or else reimburse them.
Was it unpleasant first?
No.
Those 2 years?
No, it wasn't unpleasant. It just wasn't very productive.
Did you go to work and tell your workmates, well, I wonder if we'll make it through this month before we go bellies up?
No. It was a good group of people to work with, and we worked hard.
And what did you accomplish?
we built a software system computer-aided design system that Control Data sold.
So if a guy like myself, you know, the layman, would I call you a programmer at one point in your life?
I was designing programs more than I was figuring out the mathematics behind the programs more than I was doing the programming.
I thought everything was 0-1. Isn't there something about that number?
Well, ultimately, inside the computer, it is zeros and ones.
Yeah. I that's way over my head.
Yes.
Is that earlier this morning when mm-hmm. you and I were talking about your liked arithmetic and all the way
right.
up, and the satisfaction is there. I mean, there's no...
It's no, black it feels good to figure out things. Yeah,
yeah, I was going to say, did you ever have that, wow, I look what we just did, and this is going to be a product that we figured out that could be sent to market and save the company?
Oh, it was never going to save the company. I mean, it was too small a piece of the revenue for Control Data. Their hardware was their business.
So now you went over to Honeywell.
Right.
Does the name Jeff Bakken ring a bell with you?
Yeah.
Do you know Jeff?
I don't know him.
Oh, okay. Well, Jeff Bakken is a rocket scientist.
Yes.
And he sat right where you're sitting right now, and we did a couple of shows.
Oh, nice.
And Jeff is the... took over as chairman of the board of the Pavlik Museum of Broadcasting. I was chairman.
Oh,
and he came.
Okay.
He came in, and of course his dad is Medtronics.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was talking to him, I was, wow, I'm really talking to a rocket scientist. Did you get involved in that?
Well, I worked for something called the Systems and Research Center, which was in the Honeywell's defense group. So we did. We did projects for the Army and Air Force. So, no, I didn't do any rocket science myself.
Okay. Where's the campus for IBM Rochester?
Honeywell.
Honeywell.
It doesn't exist anymore, but at that time it was in Fridley.
Okay. And you lived in Roseville.
In Roseville.
What was that commute like?
Well, it wasn't always nice. It was drive across town. And,
yeah.
The easiest way turned out to be just to wind through neighborhoods. And
did Allison go through the Roseville school district?
Yes, yes.
So she graduated from Roseville?
Roseville High School, right.
Okay. And did you go to the state fair?
Oh, yeah. The state fair was probably 6 blocks from us.
Yeah.
Within walking distance.
Okay.
And we listened to it every night.
Yeah. And how about Como Park?
Yeah, same thing.
Mm-hmm.
We would... go down there often for a walk.
It's a nice area.
Wonderful area.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's 10:28 on the Wayne Eddy Affair, KYMN, out of Northfield, Minnesota. My guest this morning is a gentleman named Glenn Castor, and he is living in Bridgewater Township, is a supervisor for the township, and also involved with the fire department, and we'll find out more about that in a moment, but we're going to take a break. We'll be right back on this beautiful sunny Wednesday. And by the way, it's the 6th day of June, and the year is 2018, in case Glenn, you want to hand off a copy of this to Allison, and she can hand it off to Larkin. And 50 years from now, they probably just have to think about the words set on a computer and it will tell its brain.
What happened when?
Yeah, we'll be back.
At Harry Brown's Family Automotive in Faribault, one of our family values is appreciating good things, making them last. That's why, through all our 50 years in business, we have taken great care to provide quality pre-owned vehicles to those who come looking. We invite you to explore our wide selection the next time you're searching for quality and value in a pre-owned car, truck, van, SUV. Why?
because the good ones are at Harry Brown's Family Automotive in Faribault. Online at harrybrowns.com.
The Craig Keller Insurance Agency in Nurse Strand reminds you that June is National Dairy Month and would like to salute the area dairy farmers for a job well done. For all your insurance needs, farm, home, auto, and commercial, contact the Craig Keller Insurance Agency in Nurse Strand.
We're back on Kim, a friend you can count on. June 9th strikes a date. What am I thinking about? Something's going on June 9th.
Well, speaking of National Dairy Month, on June 9th, Wolf Creek Dairy in Bridgewater Township, Paul and Barb Liebenstein.
That's what I...
Having everybody out for breakfast.
I got to get them on my show.
Yes, you do.
Do you have their telephone number?
I have Paul's. I'll leave it with you.
Okay, yeah. And I was told 2-3 weeks ago to get in touch with them, and I have them on the air because of June Dairy Month. Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you for reminding me. Okay, what happened to Honeywell?
I got interested in a different project. I stayed there for several years and then started a company.
You did?
So we made a measuring machine that measured screw threads using a laser. It's one of those who needs this type of products. But we sold to Boeing, we sold to NASA, some other companies.
Where did you have your company?
The company was in Bloomington.
Okay. How big was it, square footage?
It was tiny, 5,000 square feet.
Okay.
We would build one machine at a time, you know, where
Who designed the machine?
I designed the machines.
Was this something that was in the back of your mind all during your career?
The possibility came up when there was a company in Minneapolis, Cyber Optics, that developed a certain type of laser sensor that made it possible to do. And I became aware of them when I was at Honeywell. And so we use their product in ours.
Well, how many people in your company?
Oh, I think at the height of it was probably 10 people. It was never big.
Was it your company?
Well,
partners.
It started as my company, and then I raised money for it. We raised about $3 million in venture capital. So at that point, it's somebody else's company.
Yeah.
We sold it in 1996, so we started it roughly 1990, sold it in 96.
You wish you wouldn't have?
No, I was not getting along well with the venture partners.
Okay.
So it was pleasant to get out of.
Who was the salesperson that got all these government contracts?
Well, we had several people working with us, and I had lots of contacts. So I was probably as much a salesman as anything else.
So it was who you know.
That got things started, definitely. I mean, the machines sold from, I think the low-end machine was about $80,000, and the high-end was $250,000.
And you sold 10 a year?
Probably when we sold the company, we were going at about that pace.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're churning millions of dollars and not enjoying going to work.
And
board meetings.
It was essentially a break-even company at that point.
Oh, okay. So what did you do then after you sold it?
Well, I worked for the... Part of the deal was that I worked for the company that bought it.
Okay.
So it was a company, M&M Precision, in Dayton, Ohio.
So did you have to move to Dayton?
I didn't move. I commuted.
Monday through Thursday?
Yep.
Okay.
And they were part of a conglomerate, Danaher Corporation, which was a $3 billion company.
A little bigger.
A little bigger. And M&M Precision was about $60 million.
And what was your position?
I was a vice president.
By title or by
responsibility? Did I actually do anything?
Well, you know, did you have were you on the floor looking at the workers working on whatever you were making?
No, I was looking for other product opportunities for them and technology opportunities. And
did they use your contacts that you had, too?
They did. Eventually, I got tired of the commuting.
Oh, yeah, I suppose.
And I came back and I worked at Cyber Optics, the company whose sensors I started using in 1990 as the vice president of operations.
In what year?
I think that was 1998, 99.
Okay. And how long were you with Cyber Optics?
2 years, three years there.
Well, you know that song...
Then I retired.
I mentioned the song about your wife's name's Barbara.
Mm.
Okay.
Barbara Ann.
Yes. And then the song by the Beach Boys for you would be... Round, 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 I get around and get around.
That's right. It was moving from one job to another.
Holy cow, that's amazing that you've had that many jobs and high-ranking jobs, comparatively speaking. You know, you weren't getting union scale.
Yeah. So,
and you got to be inventive. You got to start your own company. You got to suffer by having people... that invested in the company to make money that's on your back constantly. Let's turn out these things. Let's get going. And they don't know from Shinola when it comes to the product.
Yeah. Well, yeah. That was the problem. They invested in the company, it turns out, because there was a law that was proposed, and it looked like it was going to pass, that would require... certain types of inspections for safety-critical aircraft parts.
Okay.
And we had probably the only machine that could do those inspections. Ah. So they were looking for a free ride here.
Well, now, when you went out looking for that venture capital, did you use that?
Oh, sure.
Selling point?
Sure.
Of course.
Yeah. Here's the way it could go, you know, and so forth and so on. But they didn't really pay attention to... the fact this was a capital equipment company. And there comes a point when people are buying a $200,000 machine when they look not only at the machine, but they look at your service and how you organize your company and so forth.
So your official retirement came in what year?
2002.
Okay, so you've been retired for 16 years.
Right.
And you're not even in your 70s.
No, I'm 71.
71, okay.
Yeah.
But still, that's pretty nice.
Yeah.
But, you know, but here you are, very talented, very intelligent, in a job profession that's limited to a certain amount of people with your education and experience, and now you're sick and tired of commuting from Dayton to Roseville, so you retire. How did you end up in Northfield is what I'm getting at all this 4 hours of conversation.
Well, because in a marriage, we started paying more attention to my wife than my job.
Okay.
I mean, that's why
I understand that.
Yeah. I retired early. We had saved enough so we could do that. So 2002 is when we actually bought the property here.
And how did you discover, if I may, Northfield?
In the mid-90s, Barbara had gotten very interested in pottery, making pottery, and then did a apprenticeship with a person up at St. John's College in Collegeville, who was an excellent teacher and an excellent potter. And we decided that this is the direction we wanted to move things, and we wanted to build a kiln and... fire pottery. You can't do that in the suburbs. So we started looking for a place we could build a house and build a pottery studio and so forth. And I forget who pointed us toward Northfield. We weren't really aware of the town at all.
That's why I'm asking.
Yeah, but they said, you know, here, this is a nice town, a good size. There should be land around.
A realtor?
No, this was just a friend.
Okay.
Could have been somebody who went to college here.
Okay.
But they said there's also people who buy pottery there. We had looked at some places out near Henderson, which were nice, but there's no customers around.
Yeah. They're known for their hummingbirds. Did you know that?
No, I didn't know that.
Oh, when you go into Henderson, I ride a motorcycle, and that's one of the trips I like to take, and there's... a lot of hummingbirds. They hang out those. Yeah, and I mean they're not like a banner and look at, you know, a cage full. I mean, they're just
there. They're there.
Yeah. So I interrupted. Yeah. Okay. So you looked at Henderson, and then you came to Northfield. How did you look around Northfield? Did you go to a realtor, or did you drive around first and say, you know, I kind of, what was your first impression?
No, we went to a realtor. I think we ended up working with Bob Gill.
Mm-hmm.
And so he took us around the countryside and explained what was available and who lived where and who had lived there 30 years ago.
Did he want to sell you part of his farm out there? Off of 19?
No, we didn't. But we're close. We're close to one of his fields and a place where he sold off.
Yeah. So then he's showing you around. And have you lived in more than one place since you've been in Northfield?
No.
Okay, so you ended up in Bridgewater Township.
Right.
The largest township in Rice County.
Yes.
I ran for county commissioner one time, but I didn't make it. But anyhow, I swallowed my pride and marched on. So where in Bridgewater Township are you?
We're in the southeast corner. So we're right on our property line is the southern edge of Bridgewater Township. And if you go out 246 and go up Gates Avenue.
It's right next to Northfield Township.
Yeah.
Okay.
Gates Avenue is the eastern boundary of Bridgewater Township, and we're about 2 miles west of that.
Okay. On a dirt road or a paved road?
No, gravel road.
Well, let me see if there are cars out here. I'm looking out our picture window at the studio.
Well, the rain has cleaned it off.
Oh, okay.
Generally, it looks like it's
I know.
Camouflaged.
You know where the tower is for KYMN?
Yep.
I figured it out how many, you're the mathematician, take 35 years and take away 2 weeks of each one of those years. Okay, got that? Now multiply that by four.
Yes.
And the number is?
200.
Thousand.
No,
well, maybe I gave it wrong. Anyhow, I put on thousands and thousands of miles on
the gravel road
on 320th Street. I always call Kim Radio Road. And so, what are we talking about? Dust. Okay.
Dust, lots
and
of
so,
it.
Don't buy a black car if you're going to live on a dirt road. I found that out years ago. So you settled in here. You when you say you wanted to build a kiln, I thought it was, am I saying that right? Kiln. I thought they were like round and had a cover. You lift up and you set the stuff in there, and they don't take. You could have three of them in here in this room.
There's electric ones that operate that way.
Oh.
And there's propane kilns.
Oh.
Which we have one of. Which are built more like a box with the door on the front, and then there's
on the front, not the top.
Generally, the front,
like an oven, you stick
right.
It. Yeah, okay.
And then there's wood fired kilns where you've got
Do you have one of those too?
Yes, we built one of those.
All three of them.
Yeah.
You do have an electric one.
We have several electric ones.
So the benefit from that is what? Why is wood better than electric? Electric better than natural? Natural better than... How does... why? Did they do something to the clay?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they have very different effects.
Okay.
And when we moved out here, in fact, we live not far from where Chuck Hollings lived, whom a lot of local people may know. He's passed away several years ago, but he was a potter. And Barbara would fire over there. But one of the things that happens when you fire pottery, of course, everything gets real hot. But with a propane kiln or a wood-fired kiln, you can sort of close things up so that the oxygen that feeds the fire is coming from the clay and from the glaze. It's pulling oxygen out. You can't really do that in an electric kiln. You have to supply the oxygen from the outside. And as a result, you get different colors and different effects on the clay. And then with the wood-fired kiln, the flame actually goes by all the pots and so forth and leaves ash, wood ash, which also affects the glaze and colors and so forth. So very, very different effects.
Here's a question. Is it a hobby or profitable? Or both?
Well, for her, it's both. I mean, it's definitely profitable on a small scale. We don't try to make a living at it.
Yeah.
There are some people here in town. The person we bought the kiln from, Donovan Palmquist, he and Colleen Riley do pottery professionally and make a living at it.
Do you get involved with the Northfield Arts Guild during Defeated Jesse James days?
Barbara is on the board of the Riverwalk Market Fair, so okay. She helped organize that. There's pop-up galleries that happen around Christmas time, so she's part of that. So, yeah, she's fairly involved in the local arts community.
Now, when you first came to Northfield, what year was it again?
We built the house in 2004.
Okay, so
that's when we moved. Okay. Yeah.
So 14 years.
Yep.
When was the first time you got involved or attended Defeated Jesse James Days?
Well, probably 2005 or 2006 we came, and then for several years she did pottery. I mean, she set up a tent.
Yeah.
And then we decided that was not worth the hassle.
Was it along the river?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
A little crowded.
A little crowded, and lots of things going on. So
yeah. Did you attend the raid reenactment?
Oh, yes.
Were you impressed?
I was very impressed.
Well, good for you.
Yes.
You know, it's my favorite project after the Northfield Historical Society, and I'm glad that you enjoy the show.
Yeah, it's quite good. A show.
13 minutes before it's 11 o'clock, we'll find out a little bit about the fire department and the Bridgewater Township deal in just a moment. But first, we want to hear from several hometown people.
A home is probably the biggest purchase you'll ever make, and you want to make sure everything goes smoothly. Call me, State Farm Agent Mark Quinnell. I not only offer homeowners insurance to protect your investment, but I can help with home loans too. No wonder more homeowners trust State Farm than any other insurance company. For information, call me, State Farm Agent Mark Quinnell at 645-4545. Providing insurance and financial services, loans are offered through State Farm Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Like a good neighbor, State Farm.
Millstream Commons Assisted Living is where the all-star seniors enjoy life in Northfield. From the delicious meals, the bright, spacious apartments, the volunteer projects, the bus trips we take, classes we attend, and the music we enjoy, there's something for everyone. At Millstream Commons, we treat everyone like an MVP. For more information, call 507-650-0141.
Hi, this is Julie from the Northfield Liquor Store. Our profits directly support the community. What does this mean? Well, did you know that over the years, since I first started working at the Muni, we have contributed over $2.5 million to pay for basic city services? This includes everything from police and fire to streets, park and recreation, and the library. So when you shop at the Northfield Muni, you support the home team. You keep the snowplows running in the winter and the potholes filled in the summer, and we thank you.
Well, thank you, Julie. That's a nice ad. I like that. I was just thinking, with your mind, which is trained and you love mathematical, which is logic, did you ever think of going into law or into police work?
No.
Never?
Never.
Okay. Wouldn't that have been cool if you did? And I figured that out, but it's up to your wife to figure out whether I'm able to figure out. So what's going on with the fire department? What's your role in what's going on there?
Well, the fire department now is organized as an independent entity, essentially, independent of Northfield, and no longer a city department. And it's managed by a board. We have eight voting members, and then several ex officio members, including the fire chief. So those are five people from Northfield, one from Dundas, and two from the townships. And so we handle everything about the fire department, finances, buying new equipment, the remodeling or updating of the building that's going on right now. All is projects initiated and managed by this board.
And what's it called?
Well, it's the Northfield Area Fire and Rescue Service.
And it's not a part of the city government?
No. It exists through an agreement between the Northfield, Dundas, and the Rural Fire District.
So to put it simple, it's a nonprofit entity that contracts with various communities.
Essentially, yeah.
Okay. So what's going to happen with what we referred to as the safety building when it was built when Marv Grundhofer was mayor back
right,
in 1970?
A long time ago.
Yeah.
For a lot less money.
So what's the next project on that particular piece of property?
Well, I mean, you can see now they're digging a holding pond in the back. Which by city code we're required to have now. But we're going through the building top to bottom. There was essentially no maintenance for 40 years. So there's a lot of things to catch up on, mechanical equipment, fixing the roof and so forth. But we also need more space. So there's an addition that'll be on the south side for four trucks, a big garage essentially.
Wow. It's going to be a big garage.
Yes.
Where's the holding pond?
If you drive by there right now, you can see the hole that's dug. The property is shaped sort of like a triangle with the V down by the bridge and the river. That's where the holding pond is.
Okay. Sounds funny, a holding pond next to a river, but
no comment.
Is it a waste of time and money?
Well, it's required by the code, so
by the city or the county, or the state.
Oh, okay. So Northfield owns the property and they own the building still. We lease from them.
Okay, so you're leasing the holding pond.
Yes, and since we're building in the city, in any case, we're required to meet the city codes.
All right, now let's switch hats here. You're involved in that. Now you're supervisor for Bridgewater Township. And what's talked about the most obvious thing, and that is the County Road 1 expansion has really has done some interesting moves for people that live in Bridgewater Heights and others.
Yeah, people in Bridgewater Heights now get to experience a gravel road, washboards, potholes, the whole nine yards. And today will help actually with the rain. The township just bought what's called a packer. I think that was probably a $30,000 piece of equipment, and that gets pulled behind the road grader. And it's essentially, as we put down gravel and blade it with the road grader, this comes right behind and packs it down. And with dust control, it should keep the road in good shape through the project.
What type of dust control do you use? There's a lot of gravel roads in Bridgewater Township. And when we were out on 320th, there were different kinds. You could use a liquid that was sprayed, and then you could use pellets, I think, of some sort. I'm not sure. What is the most effective, least expensive one that Bridgewater is using?
Well, on most of our roads, we use a spray, magnesium chloride. On 115th Street, we're really working with the county there. I mean, the county is doing the project on one. So they're responsible for the detours. So the county, sort of the agreement is they use their, What are we talking about here?
We're talking about dust control. Yeah.
So the county's using their dust control, which is a different chemical, I think.
Okay.
And we pitch in to help pay for it, and we take care of putting the road grader over the road so they don't have to do that.
Okay, here's a good one. Bridgewater Township, Dundas. So you're going south on Highway 3, and you're going to go left at County Road 1, and that takes you over to 246, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Exactly. What's Dundas and what's Bridgewater?
Well, it sort of got intermixed there when Bridgewater Heights was built. So Bridgewater Heights, of course, is in Dundas. And there's the stores down below are in Dundas. Firehouse Liquor and so forth, Gleason's. And there's a strip of land that sort of connects all that to Dundas at 3. But on as you go toward 246, of course, on your left side, there's two Bridgewater Township residential areas, Bittersweet and Timberlane. And then there's Gary Rock's farm, which stretches down to 246, and some houses right along 246. So that's all part of Bridgewater. So it's a little bit confusing. But.
Yeah. So what are they totally elevating or making a level road from Highway 3 to 246 instead of the curves and the up and downs and the high rise to you when you go to that that new home addition on the right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Up where you enter the new home addition, that land is coming down a little bit. I think it might be as much 10 feet or so in a traffic circle, and we'll be up there.
Are you talking about a turnabout or a roundabout?
Roundabout.
Oh, God.
Yeah. just as a practical way to slow things down.
And have you ever been to New Prague?
I've been to Boston. I'm well used to traffic circles.
Oh, okay. My first one was in Mexico. And
oh,
I couldn't get off it. My wife had been through one. I had never seen one before. Move to the right. Move to the right.
Yeah.
I mean, this little Volkswagen going 50 miles around. This big statue. And all. Yeah. It was crazy.
No, in Boston, they're all over. That's very common traffic control.
Well, I don't understand how they can lower the road. Then the people that live in those new homes will have to drive up to them rather than just to them.
No, it was pretty high, so it'll make it feel more level.
Okay. And taking out the curves?
No, I don't think they're taking out any curves.
Okay.
They're putting a tunnel under the road. I think that's under.
For
bicycles and,
isn't that
people
cute.
Walking.
Yeah, that'll be nice.
Yeah.
No infrastructure, no pipelines?
I don't think so. Okay. I mean, I think the project has been slowed up a little bit right now because there's difficulty moving a gas line, but otherwise.
Oh. If you just tuned in, ladies and gentlemen, you missed a good conversation between Glenn Castor and myself. He is originally from Blackfoot, Idaho, and now to Mount Pleasant, Iowa, and then into the Army in Vietnam, and then to, Northwestern and then Syracuse. Am I right?
My wife at Northwestern and me at Syracuse.
Yeah, and anyhow, he's got a doctorate degree in mathematics, and his wife has a doctorate degree in
anthropology.
And that's a study of culture, I believe. Yeah.
But she's really a Potter.
Potter.
And okay. She should have been way back when.
Okay. And that's been a lot of fun, and thank you for serving as a supervisor for where I live, Bridgewater. Nice people, by the way. You work with nice people.
Very nice, yes.
And they do it if you request something. The fellow that runs the street department there does a immediate job. Does mm-hmm. a good job. John, I think his name. I'm not sure, but anyhow, I was just thinking on our little circle that we have up my neighborhood. Gee whiz, I wish all that sand left over from the winter would go away, and the next day it was all swept. And so our thinking was right along the line of that. So I do appreciate that. We have a special show coming up. Are you into global warming?
Oh, yes.
You believe it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's hard not to believe. It's getting warmer.
Okay. Well, we have two guys that are coming in right now, and they're going to do their show, and it's all about global warming and other issues in that regard. And we will do that. It's called the KYMN Climate Show. So I want to again say thank you very much.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
All right. This is your radio station. We are KYMN, Northfield, Minnesota, 1080 on your AM dial for almost 50 years, and now the 95.1 on your FM dial.
The KYMN Climate Show is a monthly feature here on 95.1 The One and AM 1080, discussing changes in climate and the science behind it. And now, your hosts, Alan Anderson and Bruce Moreland.
And welcome to the KYMN Climate Show with Bruce Moreland and Al Anderson, where we discuss climate issues in the news and then dig into the stories behind them. Today, we're talking about climate change and agriculture. So, Bruce, what stories have you found in recent weeks?
Well, the first thing I did was I went out and looked for wacky weather and looked for some introduction to the way agriculture interacts with the weather, and that'll be fun. And then I understand that you're going to have some information on pests, and I will talk a little bit more about some rain issues and some fun things about that, and a little bit about flooding, and then we'll finish up with a little bit of talk about hail and heat. And that's the way it's going to go. It's going to be a hot day here in the studio. So, sorry. The first thing we're going to talk about is what we've called wacky weather, and I think we're going to be using that phrase a fair amount. And let's just talk a little bit about what climate is versus weather, and then we'll understand what we're trying to say.
Saying, let me just jump in and say wacky weather, you mean like snow in April, and then a couple weeks later, a run of 90-degree days?
This is Minnesota. You're supposed to have snow in April. I don't know about 90-degree days, but snow in April felt so normal. It was like I was 12 again down in Rochester. Okay, so anyway. As Paul Douglas likes to say, and I've heard him use this several times, and I have stolen it just mercilessly, climate is a measure of how many jackets you have in your closet versus how many shorts you have. And if you live down in the hot areas, you have lots of shorts and a couple jackets, and if you live in the cold areas, you have lots of jackets and just a couple shorts. And so that's what climate is what your closet looks like. It's what you're prepared for or not prepared for. The weather is what you look out the window. Am I going to wear a jacket today or am I going to wear shorts? Okay? See the difference? There's the weather is what happens on a particular day or week, whereas climate is what's happening over the whole of time. So with that in mind, we've gotten used to a certain kind of seasonal process in Minnesota, right? We're used to, as you said, snow in April. No big deal. We're supposed to have snow in April. Latest snows are supposed to happen sometimes in May. The planting season started late in the May because you don't want to put stuff out and have it frosted. It's just not good for it, you know. Frosting is good on cake, not good on your plants. So, and the same thing in the fall. We're used to having a nice fall, and it kind of blends into a nice winter, and we get some snow, and everything's safe, and we're all happy, right? That's what it's supposed to be like. But we've gotten... Not only are we used to it as like people with, you know, recreational needs like water skiing and snowshoeing, our crops are used to that. So we're growing crops that have been tailored to fit into the Minnesota style climate of a few, maybe 10 years ago, because it takes time to develop these new crops, and we'll talk later about how they're having to respond to that and what kinds of changes they're having to make. But let's back up a little bit. We're going to talk about farming. And one of the things that everybody that knows anything about farming knows that it counts on a reliable water cycle. We farm in Minnesota for lots of reasons. We farm because it has good soil. And by good soil, you know, it's not a 100,000-year-old soil. This is stuff that's built up in the 10 to 20,000 years since the end of the last ice age. So our landscape is based, except for a region called the Driftless region, is based on a kind of scrape till, the ultimate full